This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Dota from Occident Invicta. Dota, it's nice having you back on.
Thank you for inviting me over again. It's great to be back.
So we're going to be discussing primarily the events that happened in Paris and the issues relating to that, but we'll be discussing a lot of your other recent articles. But your most recent article, which was a major event, which was basically one of the major events in the news, and this event, it's a major news event, but it touches upon a lot of different issues that you have been discussing on your blog, issues of importance. The title of the article is "The Importance of Being Tolerable: Thoughts on the Shooting in France and Multicultural Stupidity." But first of all, what were your thoughts? What was your original initial reaction to the event itself when you first heard about it?
Well, I was shocked, and then I was quite appalled. And then I obviously did some research, and it turns out that this magazine apparently was, it's kind of a left-wing magazine, and ironically they've attacked nationalists, that are anti-immigration. And it is ironic, of course, that they've attacked the very people that might have been able to protect them in the first place. So that was also one of my reactions there. And also, of course, I found out in 2009 that they had fired one of their cartoonists. I think it was one of their writers for making remarks that were considered insulting, to the Jews. And so then I realized that they're really not into free speech. But that's not the point though. I was actually appalled at the attack itself. So I don't really much care for the magazine. I don't particularly respect them, but I was appalled at the brutality of the attack. And it was actually quite horrifying, you know, to have an attack take place like that in broad daylight. And it really did seem like it actually reminded me of Mumbai in 2008 when those terrorists had attacked, you know, the Taj Hotel.
Are you from Mumbai?
Yes, I am.
So you're very familiar with the hotel where it took place?
Yes, the Taj. Yeah. And it was actually quite similar in some respects, you know. But yes, in the sense that, you know, you had a city that was attacked by a bunch of militants that had found a way to get in. You know, they'd infiltrated the city, and in some ways that they managed to keep law enforcement officers and managed to keep in the case of India, in the case of Bombay, they managed to keep the army at bay for a while. And so yes, the two attacks were somewhat similar, but this one was actually shocking. So yeah, that was my reaction. So I don't really care much for the magazine itself. I was just appalled at the barbarism of the attack itself.
What are your thoughts on a lot of the different reactions to the attacks from different political groups, how they have responded to the attacks?
Well, the left is now paying lip service to free speech and all that, but that's kind of bogus. They've done everything in their power to censor free speech, and they've done everything in their power to impose, you know, the leftist narrative on society. So every time the left talks about free speech and, you know, they pay lip service to free speech, it's just shallow. It's pretty hollow. And right-wingers, obviously, then you've got conservatives, and then you've got, you know, the alternative right that have also spoken out against the attacks and spoken out against immigration. And I do tend to agree with the alternative right on this one, that immigration really is problematic. But it's not just immigration per se, it's also the kind of immigrants you're letting in. You know, you're letting in a bunch of refugees, you're letting in a bunch of immigrants that come from some fairly dysfunctional cultures. And this is bound to happen. And as I mentioned in my article, of course, that this is not an accident, you know. It's you know, the West's immigration policy is suicidal by design. You know, with every, you know, with these immigrants coming in, you know, when you're letting in immigrants coming from countries that, you know, are currently being targeted by Western armies, some of these immigrants might actually think of plotting revenge. It's not far-fetched. And so, with every terrorist attack, of course, you know, there is, of course, this, you know, we move close towards police state, with, you know, we've got people arguing for more surveillance and such. So, it's just a nasty situation.
What is your thoughts on the sort of the people who focus a lot on the issue of Islam? There's, there's sort of two extremes. There's, on one end, you have a hardcore sort of Muslim apologist who get very offended if anyone criticizes Muslims, but then on the other extreme, you get people who focus all their energy and say that Islam is exclusively the problem. So you get, I think both points of view on that issue are I think both views are idiotic.
Well, the problem with bashing Islam specifically, and I remember reading a report recently that suggested that even Canada was now reevaluating its immigration policy. Sorry, excuse me, with regards to Syria. They were going to restrict Muslim immigrants, Muslim refugees specifically. Now, I don't think that's necessarily a bad idea. In fact, given the situation, it's actually a good idea, considering that Canada isn't with the U.S. and they're committed to regime change in Syria along with the U.S. But the problem with bashing Islam exclusively is that, you know, you neglect the broader issue of immigration itself. Let's say that, okay, you keep Muslims out. I mean, Muslims are obviously a very diverse group of people, right? There's various cultures. There's Indonesians, Iranians, and Indians, and Afghans, and so on and so forth. And, you know, they don't really have a whole lot in common because they come from very different cultures. But let's say you do keep all these Muslims out. What then? Do you still want to let other immigrants in? You still want to allow third world mass immigration? It's not a really good idea. And that's ultimately the problem with this debate, is that by focusing exclusively on Islam, what people fail to realize, even on the alternative right, is that immigration itself is something that needs to be reevaluated. Like, the West's immigration policy itself needs to be reevaluated. When you're looking at immigrants coming in from societies like, say, India and China, these are very low-trust cultures, you know, and letting these people in the long run, will not help society a whole lot either. You know, it's true that they won't blow up a building or something, but in the long run, you know, it doesn't bode well for society either, especially as they continue to gain more power, more political power. In the case of, say, India, that's already happening. You know, you've got the Indian lobby in place, and they're beginning to emulate the tactics of, say, the Jewish lobby. I did mention this in my previous interview with you. And so, obviously, this does not really bode well, because the more of these minorities that show up, you know, they tend to be very tribal too. And in a democracy, what they'll do is they will pursue their own interests, some at the expense of the majority.
I think it's important to point out that you're originally from a Muslim background, but you don't currently practice Islam.
No, not really. I don't really practice. Well, there's a couple of things I do, of course, but it's basically just the force of habit. But for the most part, no, I do not.
I guess a lot of people sometimes refer to Muslims as if it's an ethnicity or a race, which is not true. There's many different ethnic groups. Could you give examples? Are some ethnic groups that practice Islam are particularly problematic, and others not so much? Could you give specific examples of the differences of which groups react differently to Islam?
Well, it's all about culture, really, and I've mentioned this many times on my website, that it's really a matter of culture. Who are these people that are coming in? You know, what sort of culture do they practice? Now, when you look at the type of Muslim immigrants in, say, the Netherlands, for example, you've got the Arabs, the North Africans, and then you have the Indonesians. A lot of the alternative right and, you know, a lot of the nationalists, much of their outrage is specifically centered around the behavior of these North African Muslims. Not a whole lot is said about the Indonesians, though. And I've gone and I've read comments on various blogs comments made by people from the Netherlands, Dutch people, and a lot of them have absolutely no issues with the Indonesians, but they're not really a fan of the Arabs. And even if you look at, say, even if you look at a country like, say, India, for example, if you look at some of the Muslims in India, their culture depends largely on the caste they were converted from. A large number of Indian Muslims were converted from the lower castes, you know, the untouchable caste.
Your group, which, forget the specific name, but from Gujarat, is, they converted to Islam from the merchant class, or the Vaisyas, when they were Hindus, but there's a difference between the caste where they're from. The, a lot of the South Asian Muslims that cause the most problems are from the lower caste.
Well, yes, in a way, because they're from the lower caste, they're not as advantaged as Muslims that were converted from the upper castes. You know, so I'm actually from the Dawoodi Bohra community, and this is one of the more privileged castes, well, groups in India. And well, just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about here, if you actually check out Forbes list of 100 most wealthy Indians, you'll notice that most of these Indians basically are from the Brahmin and the trader castes. There's not a whole lot of billionaires that come from the lower castes. There are some, but not a whole lot. They're mostly dominated by, you know, the traders, the merchant caste, and the Brahmins. And if you look at the Muslims, there's four Muslims on that list. All of those four Muslims, actually, are from the trader caste. Three of them happen to be Shias, and one of them is a Sunni, and that Sunni is actually a Maimon, which is basically from the Lohanat caste, which is basically a mercantile caste. So, caste plays a huge role. So again, when you're looking at Muslims, it all depends on what their culture is, where they come from, whether it's India or Arabia or wherever, you know. So it really is all about culture. But the problem here is that what's happening is, and I know the left accuses the right of doing this, but essentially the media has been, the liberal media has been doing this for all over a decade. You know, they've been treating Muslims like an ethnicity, and pretty much everyone has now begun to see Muslims as an ethnicity, you know.
Well, I'll give you an example. Bill Maher is actually similar in the sense to the magazine in France, in the sense that he's a liberal who's very critical of Islam, but he had a leftist Palestinian woman on the show, and she called him a racist for criticizing Islam. So in a sense, she's sort of implying that Islam's a race herself by calling him a racist.
Well, this is the problem with leftists, though, and I know what we talked about this in our last interview. What the left really does is that they don't use, their definition of racism is basically just xenophobia. You know, there's people that can be prejudiced against religion or them, but that's not necessarily racism. Racism has a very specific definition. It's an ideology, you know, where you rank human beings, you rank people's self-worth based on their race, and you believe certain races are inherently superior because they possess certain characteristics that make them superior to other races. And that's racism. And by that definition, there's very little racism in North America. But that's not going to happen because, as far as the left is concerned, to them, xenophobia is racism. Because if they were to subscribe to the traditional definition of racism, then they wouldn't be able to peddle white guilt. So when people talk about, you know, Islam being a race, and, I mean, you know, criticizing Islam is racism, they're just basically, you know, they're just basically following that trend where if a group is offended, then they can just play the race card and you can just call it racism. But Islam is not a race, obviously. It's it just isn't. It's like, I mean, it's like stating that Italians and Filipinos are the same people, you know, just because they're both Catholic. It doesn't work that way. They're two very different cultures, you know, ethnically and linguistically. And so it's the same with the Muslim world as well. And this is becoming a problem because the left, the media now has begun to treat Muslims as a race, you know. So, but like I said, the issue here is actually immigration, though. The issue here is largely immigration. And even if you were to say stop Muslim immigration altogether, right, you're still getting other third world immigrants coming into this country, and that's still not a very good thing in the long run.
Yeah, because there's some people who act as if Muslim immigrants are the only group of immigrants that are causing problems. I mean, the United States has a lot of problems with open borders, and the majority of immigrants coming to the United States are not Muslim.
Well, yes, but again, religion is not really the variable we should be looking at, though. I mean, let's say you've got, say, you know, illegal Mexicans coming into the U.S. Now, they're Christian, but does that mean that, you know, we should open the border to Mexico? I mean, the U.S. should open its border to Mexico? No, it doesn't work that way. Religion is not really the variable you should be looking at. It's culture that's the variable that you should be looking at. But most people have a hard time telling the two apart, especially with the case of Islam, because the media has been doing this for a while. They've been treating Muslims as an ethnicity. So it is a tricky situation. It requires a bit more nuance, but that's just the way the issue has been treated, which is rather unfortunate, actually.
And that's basically the overall theme of your article that you wrote in response to the shooting, is that basically you say that the importance of being tolerable, but you're saying that people are too tolerant of things that they should not be tolerant of. Is that basically what you're getting? That's basically the main point of that post.
Well, the problem is the word tolerance itself and what it's come to mean today. You know, I mean, in the old days, the old left, which championed free speech, you know, the left of John Locke or John Stuart Mill, the old left actually believed, and Mill especially believed, and I mean, I read his essay on liberty a while ago, actually. And what he was actually getting, what the point he was trying to make in his essay was that we should tolerate a diversity of opinions, not necessarily a diversity of races. That's the tolerance that the old left would champion, that, you know, it's good to have diverse opinions because that helps us evaluate something in a reasonable way. It helps us evaluate an issue in a reasonable way when you consider all angles, and then it helps you arrive at a decision. A sound decision, you know, a logical decision. But today's left, on the other hand, has degraded the meaning of the word tolerance. To today's left, tolerance is just about tolerating anything without any boundaries, you know. I mean, tolerance without boundaries will lead to cultural suicide.
Well, that actually isn't true. There's things that they have zero tolerance for. They have zero tolerance for dissenting opinions.
Yeah, that's true, but it's just that, you know, in the old left actually believed that free speech is something that should have been tolerated, but it didn't necessarily mean that people could flout societal conventions and, you know, celebrate deviant behavior. That's not what they were actually getting at. So that is the old definition of tolerance, and the left has pretty much perverted it today. So the word tolerance itself has become somewhat problematic in my view. What does it mean in today's times, you know? In today's times, I wouldn't say there are no boundaries. There are some boundaries, obviously. And things like, say, child pornography, clearly intolerable, whether you're left or right. But for the most part, you know, in today's society, it's basically just a do-what-you-want culture. And that was not the old definition of tolerance, you know, so...
This ties in with the issues of the shootings and immigration in Europe. And you had an article called "When Immigrants Are Wiser Than Natives," and it's in response to the rapes that were happening in the UK, and these crimes were being committitted by Pakistanis.
Oh, yes. Yeah, this was the sex grooming thing going on in the UK. And I had this discussion with my wife. She's new to Canada. And so when I had this discussion with her,
is she from a Muslim background as well?
She is. She is, and she's from India. And when I had this conversation with her, her initial reaction was, well, why don't they just throw the Pakistanis out? You know, and I said to her that's out of the question here. In the West, that would never happen. They never deport people. Yeah, and they've never repatriated citizens. And then she said that, well, okay, if that's not happening, then why don't we just block? Why doesn't the UK just block, ban Pakistani immigrants? Now, what's interesting about this is that her questions are actually very logical. And in any other part of the world, you know, these issues will not even be debated. You know, governments would just take the steps required to protect their citizens. Like in India, for example, if there are Bangladeshi illegals and if there are Well, a lot of them get by on forged documents and such, but if they're ever found out, then they're deported. You know? Unless they find ways to evade the authorities, but that's a different matter altogether. But, you know, they're found out, they're deported. Same in places like Dubai and, you know, Saudi Arabia or, you know, the GCC countries or any other country in the world would simply do that. I mean, they would simply just deport these people. They'd deport troublemakers. But in the West, that's clearly not happening. You know, leaders aren't taking steps to protect their people. You know, and, you know, as an immigrant, she can see these things clearly. But people that have lived here all their lives, or have, or lived here for lived in the West for a considerable number of time, considerable bit of time, you know, and you know, whose thinking has been influenced by political correctness, they don't necessarily see it that way. You know, as an immigrant, she tends to see these things more clearly, you know, because in other parts of the world, this sort of behavior isn't tolerated. You know, these issues are not even debated. It's just here in the West. We debate issues like illegal immigration, and you know, you have people saying, you know, people, you know, chanting misguided slogans like no human being is illegal. I mean, in any other part of the world, if you have, you know, a group that's come in, if you've got immigrants that have come in and they're troublemakers, then they will be deported, they'll be kicked out. There's no question about it. So, you know, in some ways immigrants do see things very clearly. She also sees Canada as a white country. Now, if you ask a Canadian and say, is Canada a white country, most of them would say, oh no, it's, you know, we're a secular country, we're multicultural and whatnot. But, you know, she sees it for what it is. Canada is a white country. It's an Anglo-Saxon country. And there's nothing wrong in admitting this, you know, no more than admitting that China is a Chinese country, or India is an Indian country, or Korea is Korean, or Japan is Japanese. Every country, every society has an ethnic character, you know. But the left obviously claims that, oh well, you know, if, because America and Canada are not nation states, their ethnic identity is moot. But that's not how it works. These societies still have an ethnic character, and you know, immigrants to North America see this. You know, I'd mentioned this in our last interview as well. But when I had a friend, he had moved to New Zealand, and he told me before moving to New Zealand, this was when I was in high school, and he said to me that, well, I'm going to be moving to a white country. You know, it was just a normal thing to say. And then, of course, when I got up with him about 5 or 6 years later and I said, you know, how's life in a white country? And he was like, well, what's a white country? You know, and he was offended.
So he changed his opinion in such a short period of time.
Yes, that's what happens. See, when these people, when immigrants move to a country, they're very keenly aware of the ethnic character of the country they're moving to. And immigrants just know this, you know. I mean, Indians who move to Dubai understand that they're moving to an Arab country. Anyone who moves to Dubai understands that they're moving to an Arab country. You know, you're aware of the ethnic character of the society you're moving to. All immigrants are aware of this. And it's interesting because when they move to those societies, when these immigrants eventually move to Canada and America, you've got leftists who are agitating on their behalf. You know, this agitation sort of, you know, it acts as a barrier to assimilation. These people should be assimilating slowly but surely, but when you have leftists claiming that the majority is oppressive, you know, the white majority is oppressive, and you know, you have to be on your guard, and they're racist and so on and so forth, then it acts as a barrier to assimilation. You know, these people then begin to internalize these messages. Rather than trying to assimilate, they then in some ways reflexively just segregate themselves. And you see that, and there's quite a bit of segregation here in Canada as well, especially in cities like Toronto, for example. Possibly even Vancouver, but I haven't really been to Vancouver. I visited Vancouver once, but I didn't spend much time there. But Toronto is a very segregated city.
And you also, you had a post about this. You recently visited India, and you talk about what are some of the changes you've noticed, Western influence in India. What parts of India did you visit? Just Mumbai?
I visited Mumbai. My family lives in Mumbai, and then I visited a few towns around the state of Maharashtra. And I visited a little town called Rajnandgaon, which is about 600 kilometers away east of Bombay. And I did notice a few interesting changes there. I mean, there certainly is a climate of rape hysteria in India right now, you know, and this despite the fact that India's rape statistics are not all that terrible. When you actually get down to looking at the details, you know, yes, you know, sexual assault and these issues are a problem. no doubt, but the media has exaggerated it. Now you have all these memes turned into the back of train tickets about, you know, liberating women, and, well, it's also also liberation in the Western sense of the word, but it's just that these slogans and, you know, these messages, what they're trying to do is, the government's trying to get Indians to respect women, specifically, but they're not like the feminist memes you see in the West, which are more, which are rebellious in nature and, you know, entitled and, you know, petulant and don't. These memes are somewhat different here. These slogans in India are somewhat different, though. They're just actually getting Indians to respect women, respect them as wives, respect them as mothers. And, well, of course, I'd say feminism is about 100 years, you know, Indian feminism is about 100 years behind the West, so that's probably what accounts for the difference.
What are some of the other, are there any other changes that you've noticed in India since the last time you've been there?
Well, Bombay has changed considerably, and you know, the new airport is actually quite good. But when you leave the cities, and you leave the major cities, the rest of the countryside, well, there's not a whole lot of change. There's not a whole lot of changes there. You have issues pertaining to, you know, healthcare and sanitation and the lot. So as I was, you know, as I took a train from, you know, as I was on the train to the little town Rajnagar, and I was looking out, and I was looking at some of the villages on the way, some of the little settlements along the way, and they seem to be completely untouched by the passage of time. They don't really have electricity. I doubt they've got running water, and it's quite depressing. It's actually quite depressing, though. So in some ways, India is actually very much like China, where big cities are now being showcased through the world, and as soon as you leave the cities, you see a very different India, you know, an India that's actually, well, it's actually quite depressing. But yes, just like China, India has now begun to, you know, invest extensively in their cities, in the infrastructure in their cities. They still have a long way to go, and they're still about 20 or 30 years behind China, but that's the route. That's basically the road that they're on. You know, they're investing in their cities, but there's almost no investment in villages and, you know, in rural settlements and such, which is unfortunate, because 50% of Indians live in villages and, you know, in rural settlements. So it's not something they should ignore, but it seems that they are. They're quite indifferent to rural settlements.
So would you say that India is a low trust society?
India definitely is a low trust society. So is China, actually, for that matter. But India definitely is a low trust society. You're looking at a society that's been segregated for over 3,000 years. So it's bound to produce a society that is very low trust. And it's a society that tends to self-segregate itself. So when you look at Bombay, it is a very segregated city. You got some areas in Baikala that are basically just Muslim areas, and then you've got some areas that are dominated by, you know, Marathis, and some areas are basically Patel-dominated, Gujaratis, and so on and so forth. It is a very segregated city, and it's oppressively segregated, actually. But it is a very low-trust society because of this. You know, it's a society that's obsessed with saving face, and it's very collectivist, and it most definitely is low-trust.
And I know the name. What are the Patels? Because that's sort of a stereotypical Indian name in the United States.
The Patels are actually, they're the dominant peasant caste of Gujarat. And for some reason, there's a lot of them in the U.S. and there's not as many of them in Canada. I'm not sure why that is, but it's just the way it is. There's a lot of them in the U.S., but I've seen very few here in Canada. I mean, I've seen a few in the prairies, but there seem to be more Punjabis in Canada, and there's more Patels in the U.S. So they're basically the dominant peasant caste of Gujarat. And they tend to be more nationalistic than some of the other Indians and some of the other Gujaratis. Very, very nationalistic. Hindu nationalist, that is, compared to some of the other Gujaratis.
And you actually had a post up on the site Return of the Kings.
Right.
Yeah, so did they contact you to write that article, or you offered to write it?
No, I offered to write it. I wrote the article and I submitted it over to them. And my understanding was that they either accepted or rejected. They rejected it, then I just ran it on my own website. But they liked it, and so they uploaded it. Obviously I had to clean it up a bit, do a bit of editing, and they liked it. And it got a pretty decent response as well from the community there.
And so you've been following that site for quite some time. I know on, this is a little bit off topic from the article, but I know on Roosh's forum, like, they like to bash Indian men a lot. Have you noticed that?
I haven't actually visited Roosh's forum. I do read Return of Kings from time to time, but I'm not really acquainted with Roosh's forum very much. I do understand that, they've had a commenter called the Indian Race Troll or something of the sort.
Yeah.
I don't know a whole lot about it, to be honest with you. I've never really visited Roosh's. I mean, I have looked at his actual website, his forum a couple of times, but, Return of Kings is what I tend to read, though. They've got a pretty interesting bunch of writers there, and
Someone did write an article about Indian women on the site Return of the Kings. Did you read that?
That was Matt Forney, actually.
Oh yeah.
Five reasons not to date an Indian girl, or something to that effect. Yeah, that was Matt Forney's article. The article was. it did ruffle some feathers, but I think he has some interesting points there, actually. I tend to agree with some of the points. Bear in mind, he's referring to Indian women in the U.S. specifically. And he's right about some things. He's right about the fact that a lot of them are feminists. This is true, actually. And there's some examples in my own family. But I don't know why that is. But it's just the way it is. And actually, well, you know, there is something else I wanted to mention about this along these lines. I have noticed that in Western universities, at least in Canada, there are certain courses that tend to specifically target women of color and then pull them into the fold of feminism. So I remember taking a course, and this was basically a secular course on Islamic tradition. So it was basically a deconstructionist approach to Islam. You know, in the same way as you deconstruct the Bible and put the Bible in its historical context, you know, textual criticism, redaction criticism, so on and so forth. The same stuff would apply to Islam. And I do notice that towards the second half of the course, there was a disproportionate emphasis on Islamic feminism. And, I mean, I understand the course is about Islamic tradition, yes. You know, Islam over the years, Islam over the centuries and such, but there was this disproportionate focus on Islamic feminism and trying to engage the Islamic, you know, some of the Muslim women in class, and Muslim girls in class, and trying to draw them into the fold of feminism. So I have noticed that there is this effort on campuses, at least from my experience, to get these women of color into the fold of feminism. And it's quite possible that's one of the reasons why a lot of these Indian women also tend to become feminists. A lot of these people, a lot of Indian immigrants and their children tend to be college educated.
That's what it is, because they want to be part of the elite and upper class in the United States, and they basically, to do that, you basically have to adopt a lot of the thinking and ideologies of the upper class in America.
Well, yeah, that could be it. That could be it. And there really is an effort to get these women of color to embrace some of the dogmas of feminism. I have seen it, so that could partially be it. And of course, they come from a culture that is very patriarchal, so, you know, in some ways they probably feel that they're righting a wrong. Even though, as Forney pointed out, you know, these women tend to be very privileged, especially, especially Indian women that are born in the U.S. They tend to be very privileged indeed. So, it is a bit of a mystery, actually, as to why so many Indian women gravitate towards feminism.
So your article over at Return of the Kings is called "Why the World Would Not Be a Better Place If Women Ruled."
Yeah. In the article, I write about the fundamental differences between the way men and women think. You know, men are by and large obsessed with justice and fairness. Every civilization, you know, has a certain ideal of justice. you know, even in societies that we may consider are, you know, unjust by Western standards, like say India's society, for example, but even the Indians were, you know, they had their own ideals of justice. And there's, you know, there's various, you know, there's various texts that talk about justice. Some of the Dharma Shastras, for example, talk about justice. And, you know, every Indian society, I mean, every society in the world, every major civilization has its own ideal of justice. And justice is basically where civilization begins. I mean, if you look at, say, the Republic, you know, what's one of the first discussions that takes place in the Republic? It's basically a discussion about justice. And then you've got, you know, the various, you know, you've got various people talking about giving their own definitions of justice. And then in the end, Plato gives his own definition of justice, which is basically centered around interdependence. You've got a city, you've got various people coming together, and interdependence is basically at the heart of justice. And when you look at the way the women behave, there doesn't seem to be any sense, they don't seem to be guided by any sense of justice as such. Women tend to be more opportunistic in nature, as, you know, and that's just part of their evolutionary psychology. Women have always been provided for historically, and they've always competed with other women, the most eligible male. So women tend to be more opportunistic. They've always been provided for, and their imperative is to actually accumulate resources. So, and I mean, if you look at the trend of hypergamy, which is something that the Manosphere talks about quite a bit, you know, that is a form of opportunism. You know, trying to trade up in the mating game, so to speak. And that is, of course, in a way, a form of opportunism. Because, you know, female nature is more opportunistic, I don't really think the world would be a better place to women rule. There would be no sense of justice in society. I mean, if you just look at the way women misuse laws in society today, you know, whether it's false rape accusations or, you know, the way they initiate divorce just to make a grab for a man's wealth, you know, launching these custody cases just so that they can continue extorting money from their husbands. And
because they usually say, feminists will say that that women are more egalitarian minded, and that if you get more women into politics, you will actually reduce inequality in society. That's usually, like, they bring up that argument all the time.
Yeah, and I frankly don't understand that argument, because I don't see how you can focus on equality by, you know, focusing exclusively on the interests of one sex over the other, at the expense of the other, mostly. So I don't, and it seems that feminists, and it seems that women are more, you know, inclined towards egalitarianism, because a lot of them support the welfare state. But of course they do so out of self-interest, not necessarily for the interest of society, but, you know, their own self-interest. So I don't necessarily believe that women are egalitarian, though. I mean, they're opportunistic by nature, so it's very opposite of egalitarianism in my view.
And you have this other post, Why Feminism Fails in the Third World. And you have this chart up. You talk about the difference between case selection and R selection, and that's basically a theory of evolutionary psychology. But can you explain the key differences between case selection and R selection?
Well, for starters, I should point out, I'm not sure if I'm actually sold onto the theory, but I did notice that feminism does thrive in societies that tend to have, you know, that tend to be affluent and have an abundance of resources. And It's interesting, because in the third world, you've got various third world countries, and feminists claim that they're patriarchal and such. But I do believe ultimately that these societies cannot afford feminism, quite literally. You know, I mean, if you look at the two evolutionary models, you've got the R selection. The focus is to, well, multiply basically, and because resources are abundant, and there's low group loyalty. Inner group loyalty as such, and you know, low investment parenting, and we're seeing that in North America right now with the rise of the single mother household and how single mothers are glorified. We're seeing society move towards a low investment parenting model, and you know, in the third world, of course, where resources are scarce, feminism has an upkeep, is what I'm actually trying to say. And it's an upkeep that third world countries cannot afford to pay, because, I mean, from an evolutionary point of view, you know, women were never meant to be independent, you know, and if women are going to be independent, then there is a cost, and that cost is borne by society. whether it's through, you know, welfare programs and, you know, affirmative action and child support and whatnot, or whether it's, you know, children that grow up in daycare that tend to have lower IQs than other kids who were raised by stay-at-home parents, stay-at-home mothers, the cost is borne by society, you know, and also the male taxpayer. So in the third world, you don't have those resources that can sustain feminist programs. And the fact is, and the greatest case against feminism can be made from the, can be made by this argument that, you know, if independence, if female independence was natural, then why is there an upkeep to it? You know, why do you need to have a whole lot of social programs and benefits and such to enable women to be independent? Why is there a bill? You know, and why is it that men have to foot that bill? You know, I mean, in the case of men, men are independent. You know, I mean, that's just their nature. That's just the way it is. But in the case of women, it's a different story. Women's independence has an upkeep. And whichever, and wherever feminism goes, you'll see an increase in government spending. And in the third world, you know, governments just don't have that money. Now you have Western elites that are trying to, sort of correct this imbalance. And they're trying to spread feminism in the third world. So just say, you know, Bill Gates, for example, Bill and Gates, their foundation. They've got this global fund for women or something to that effect. And they've donated a few million dollars there, and it's supposed to help women in places like Africa, you know, access to healthcare and education and so on and so forth. But that's basically where these Western elites come in, because they understand that feminism requires resources. You know, it's not a sustainable ideology. And so these elites will then foot the bill. They want to spread feminism into the third world, and they'll foot the bill. And that's kind of what Bill Gates and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been doing for a while. They've also been supporting women farmers in the third world as well. I remember reading about that somewhere. But that's what they've been doing.
Do you think as the economy in the United States continues to decline and you see a destruction of the middle class, do you think that could have an effect on feminism?
It might, actually. It's a point that's been brought to my attention. I haven't given it a whole lot of thought, but it is possible that this might have an impact on feminism. I have read some statistics recently, and by recently I mean about a couple of months ago, where I'd seen some statistics about more women choosing to stay at home and raising their kids and such. And I've been wondering if that has to do with, you know, the declining economy and, you know, women just choosing to, you know, get married and go through the traditional model of marriage. And I've often wondered if this is due to declining resources. It might have an impact. It really might. But again, you have to understand that there still are a lot of resources in North America. Those resources might not be controlled by the middle class. And so we're looking at an increasingly impoverished middle class. And we seem to think that where are all the resources going? But our elites are still flushed. So as long as they control the vast majority of resources, there will be an upkeep. And, you know, feminism will endure. So, you know, when we're talking about a declining economy, we're looking at it from a purely middle class perspective. Yes, the middle classes are actually getting poorer in some ways. They're suffering a declining standard of living. But as far as our elites are concerned, they're still flushed. And as long as they've got the resources to sustain the feminist endeavor, you know, to sustain feminism, then they will. I mean, throughout the 80s and throughout the 70s and 80s, you know, you've got these elites that have been, you know, funding feminism. The Fords, for example, the Ford Foundation is pretty much funded virtually, most of the women's studies departments across North American campuses. The Rockefellers have been doing the same, sort of the Carnegies and, you know, the rest. So as long as they've got resources, they will continue to fund feminism, because it's in their interest to do so. Though it broadens the tax base, it plummets wages, and of course, in some ways, and of course, as women have the right to vote, women gain more political clout and such. What will happen is that they will, of course, clamor for a bigger government, a more intrusive government.
Yeah. And you basically have this post, feminism's corporate benefactors, but it's basically the same reason the corporations and the elites, they support mass immigration, because they basically want to increase the size of the workforce and the consumer base as much as possible. So it's basically they do it for their own economic gain.
Yes, they do. It is purely economic, actually. A lot of the social justice tomfoolery is basically
economic. I mean, the goals are basically economic. Follow the money trail. With regards to immigration and feminism, they both serve elite. They both serve elite interests. Yes, you're right. They do. They do broaden the tax base. They also broaden the consumer base. And so, from the point of view of corporations, it's for them. It's, you know, it's a good thing. But immigrants also require a welfare state. A lot of them demand these resources. So we're seeing a gradual shift towards, you know, a bigger and a more intrusive welfare state. And ultimately, that does not bode well for society. You know, once you get a population that's in some ways hooked on to the welfare state, the state can then exercise coercion by denying these benefits to people. I mean, you've seen this in Singapore, in places like Singapore, where you've got public housing, which is affordable, and about 80% of Singaporeans live in public housing. But then I have also read reports where dissidents are then denied this housing. You know, so you've got the state, and, you know, sure, it seems egalitarian, and they hand out, you know, they're giving out these benefits and such, but then these benefits can also be used, there could be a double-edged sword in some ways, a double-edged weapon. You know, denial of benefits could in some ways be, you know, a type of coercion.
Well, the same thing happens in the private sector, where if you could lose your job. I mean, ironically is that a private sector corporation is more likely to fire someone for their views than for someone to be cut off from government benefits for their views. But both scenarios are likely could happen.
Yes. The scenario I mentioned would probably take about a few decades. But yes, you're right. Governments, corporations could fire you for your views, but that's mostly because they're afraid of negative publicity. They really don't really care about your views. Most corporations, most companies don't really care about your views. That's not how businesses work. Businesses are only interested in a couple of things: net profits and productivity. So they don't really care about people's views. It's just that in recent times you've had social justice warriors becoming more and more powerful and throwing their weight around. So you've seen corporations that are trying to shy away from negative publicity. And shielding themselves from negative publicity against a band of social justice warriors that are very organized, especially on the internet.
And this other post you have is called Portrait of the Alpha Male. What was your original context for this post?
Well, I do know that a lot of PUAs have a certain definition of alpha. Now, bear in mind, I wasn't reading Return of Kings when I had written this article. Well, now I've come to realize Return of Kings actually, they feature a group of writers that, that subscribe to a diverse range of opinions, and of course they discuss a diverse range of topics on the website. Everything from, well, game obviously, but even self-improvement, working out, money management as well. I've seen some stuff there on money management as well. But I do know traditionally the PUAs had a certain, and of course, you know, they've come, Return of Kings has come a long way, but, you know, they're not the only members of the PUA community. There's still, you know, a large number of PUAs out there that have a certain, subscribe to a certain definition of alpha.
And you actually criticize their definition. You say it's, shallow. To base that definition, their outlook of things, you say it's, too shallow and simplistic.
Yeah, it's based on their score, basically, you know, how many women you can sleep with, and yeah, I don't think that's a very good definition for an alpha male. It's true, alphas actually don't have a very hard time getting laid. There's no doubt there. But there's more. But what I was arguing in the article is that there are certain alpha males tend to have certain characteristics, and these are characteristics that they're usually born with, and. Or sometimes you can acquire these characteristics depending on changes in your environment. But it is actually very difficult to inculcate these characteristics through conscious effort. You could do it, but a lot of these characteristics are just innate. And that's one of the reasons why alphas tend to be leaders of men, natural leaders of men. And that's also one of the reasons why they're only, you know, about 10% of the population. Not everyone can be an alpha. You know, and that's one of the things, that's one of the things I'm trying to debunk here, because, I mean, I understand in the PUA community, they teach men to imitate and emulate alpha behavior. But these men are basically, I'm using a term that was used in the manager itself, betas and camouflage, so to speak. You cannot have a society full of alphas because that would be a very, very low trust society.
Are there societies that do fit that, that basically are like that?
Yeah, there are. I would say there's societies like, say, the Afghans or maybe the Arabs, I would think, where you've got, there's a disproportionate amount of emphasis placed on what's known as manliness, especially among the Arab world. Islam, believe it or not, actually tried to discourage some of these traits.
You would say those traits are encouraged more in the Arab world than they are in India.
Yes, I would definitely say so. Yes. It was a society, it's also because Arab society is traditionally characterized by a society that is very clannish and where resources are scarce. So there's fierce competition for limited resources. So yeah, you've got a society that encourages, you know, traits of manliness and where disputes are settled violently. And you can still see that even in today's society. Saving face is actually a very big deal in Arab society even today. But that's also the case in India. But it's a very big deal in the Arab world even today. So you have some cultures that are like that. But then again, if you look at these cultures, they're very Hobbesian, right? They're characterized by constant strife and warfare and such. So you cannot really have a society full of alphas. And, you know, alphas are about 10% of the population. There's a very good reason for that. And as I've argued in my article, betas are actually the building blocks of civilization, you know. Sure, I mean, Pharaoh and his family might be alphas, yes, but the ones building the pyramids are probably betas. You know, I mean, they're the ones that actually build civilization. And so that's why there's a very good reason why, you know, there is that natural balance where alphas are a small percentage of the population, whereas the vast majority of people are actually just betas. And alpha characteristics are not that easy to emulate. You know, you're either born with them or you're not. Or, of course, depending on your environment, you might...
So you're not totally agreeing with them that they're basically, the PUAs would say those are the best traits to follow, but you're saying there's definitely negative traits associated with that, and you say that religion has traditionally played a role in policing that behavior, as well as you basically say that religion aimed to suppress the negative traits of women, amorality, sophism, while bringing out the better ones, self-sacrificing and nurturing behavior. And you also say it suppresses sociopathic tendencies of alphas, predatory instincts, while bringing out their qualities, loyalty, and focus.
Right. That's the point I tried to make there, that there are, you know, there's certain, alphas have certain traits. The traits could be positive or negative. And the whole point of religion is to, of course, suppress negative traits. You know, alphas can be, they can be ruthless, of course. They can be very territorial. And, they can be predatory. There's no doubt there. But they also have certain other traits, such as loyalty. You know, and the whole point of religion is to bring out those positive traits. And like I mentioned, even Islam, actually, believe it or not, tries to suppress some of the manly traits. Some of the characteristics associated with Arab manliness. But again, of course, it didn't really succeed very much because ultimately culture reigns supreme, especially in the Middle East and, well, anywhere in the world for that matter. But that's kind of the point, because alphas are basically leaders of men. They just are natural leaders of men in some ways. They've got a certain force. They radiate a certain force, making them natural leaders of men. So when they have those characteristics where they're in a position of power over other men, it's vital that, you know, there's a culture that helps them nurture some of their more positive characteristics while suppressing some of the more negative ones.
Have some religions been more effective in policing those traits than others? And have some religions really failed at policing those traits?
Well, I know that's the focus of religion. I mean, that's one of the focuses of religion. But I do think also that culture plays a much larger role in this, in enabling some of these traits. I would think that, in theory, Christianity plays a pretty good role. Christianity actually has a, you know, it has a tendency to suppress these traits at more effectively than, say, Islam, for example. But then you have to also understand that, you know, the two religions evolved in very different environments. Christianity evolved in in a more or less urban setting. And Islam evolved in a society that was far more primitive than the one that Jesus lived in 600 years before. So I would say that Christianity does a pretty good job at it, in my view. Islam to some extent as well. Islam's focus is on basically preventing abuse, as I've argued in some of my other articles. And that's actually key. So when you actually look at Islamic Sharia, for example, Islamic jurisprudence, you'll see that Islam is not entirely compatible with democracy because it's not about empowering the individual in the same way as, you know, in the same way as Western civilization, where Western civilization believes in emancipation through empowerment. Whereas what Islam does is that it tries to prevent abuse. So in some ways, these are safeguards that prevent certain individuals, you know, like alphas, for example, from abusing their power. You know, there's certain safeguards, there's certain mechanisms in place that would prevent the abuse of women, such as the mehr, for example, which is dowry. Well, it's not really dowry, but it's kind of the opposite of dowry. And, you know, you have, and, you know, safeguard, you know, slaves as well, you know, their rights in some ways are also safeguarded. So you've got these various religions that try to suppress certain tendencies, you know, some of these tendencies.
So we are basically getting out of time. Is there anything else you'd like to add about any of these topics we've touched upon?
Well, I did want to briefly mention that my article on Paris, I did want to mention that cultural Marxism, specifically immigration, feminism, and, you know, modern liberalism, they tend to serve the same elite agenda. I know we've discussed these issues, but it's important to really see this. And
yeah, I think very much so, because a lot of people get very obsessed with one issue. Some people get very obsessed with Islam. Some people talk about feminism nonstop. But those are just the symptoms. You have the root. It's not the root cause of the problem.
The root cause is obviously elites that are trying to further their own power and their own interests. And it is important to actually see these things holistically. I know there's people that think that, I know I've been called this. A lot of people think I'm paranoid about this, you know, when I talk about the police state and how we're heading down that path towards a police state. But you have to understand that historically, I mean, I know people, conservatives especially, make this argument. They claim that, okay, you know, human beings love freedom and such, but if you actually consider the history of civilization from Jericho to the United States, we haven't spent most of our time being free over the last 10,000 years. We spend most of our time being not free. This idea of freedom that we take for granted and, or some people would cherish in the West today, is only about 200 years old out of 10,000. So, When we discuss these issues, you know, and when we discuss, you know, the encroaching police state and the intrusive nanny state, it's not very far fetched to say that, you know, this is, you know, these trends are you know, these outcomes are actually on the horizon, because this is basically just us moving towards, you know, the global historic mean. We spend most of our, you know, human civilization has been not free for most of its history. So it's not entirely paranoid to think that, you know, there are forces in society that are conspiring to take these rights away from us. So that's sort of what I wanted to add there.
Okay, well, Dota, we've covered a lot of topics. It's been a great show, so thanks for being on.
Thank you for having me back. I appreciate it.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.